Extend Christian greetings to each one again this evening. Greet you in Christ's name. And we also realize that today is a day that we remember a very dark event in human history when God incarnate was, as we've been reminded this evening, when God incarnate was hung on a tree, crucified, tortured, slandered, falsely accused, and so on. And I'm not planning to speak specifically to that this evening, but it provides us with a very good basis for my message this evening, which is the sin of bitterness. And I am addressing this subject this evening because some time ago, and in situations fairly close to home, I witnessed and am witnessing some of the effects of bitterness. And I had decided then that if I have the opportunities to preach as I am amongst you this week and wherever, that I'm always going to have a message on bitterness. And so I'd like to do that this evening. But as I said, what Brother Glenn shared this evening was very timely. And as we think about Christ and the example that he gave us in dealing with bitterness, after all this trial, this mock trial that he had and the torture that he endured, and when someone very near to him, one of his own apostles, betrayed him into the hands of the guards and those who would arrest him. And after all that, and after Jesus was crucified, at least from the scripture this evening, I take it that he was crucified, and then he said, "Father, forgive them." And forgiveness is such a big part of dealing with bitterness. Those two, you can't separate. I mean, I don't know of any cure for bitterness other than forgiveness, or at least part of the cure for it. And so we realize that the Jews were the Jews. I don't want to make that too general. There are a lot of more, of course, but mainly it was the leaders of the Jews, the Sanhedrin, that were so opposed to Jesus, and for various reasons. But he had failed to meet their expectations. You know, they expected him to be a military or a political leader that would overthrow this Roman oppression and set him free, rather than developing this spiritual kingdom that was not of this world. And they had a lot of jealousy and fear. They felt, these religious leaders felt, that they were losing their power and their status. And as Jesus' popularity grew, that became more so. And then he said that he was divine. And he said he had the authority to forgive sins. And some of them held that as blasphemy. And so the leaders felt threatened by him. And so they did everything they could to shame him, set him up as a heretic, and even then they brought him to the cross. And you know, if I would have been in Jesus' shoes, I think I would have thought, okay, I know I need to go through with this. It's been prophesied. I'm not going to disappoint the Father. I volunteered to do this, like we read in Hebrews 10. I volunteered to do this. I'm going to go through with it. But I hope judgment comes on them someday. My Father, you know, he'll recompense them. And I can't wait till that day. But Jesus doesn't. Hanging on the cross, as a brother read this evening, he says, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." He didn't say, "Father, I'm going to have to give it over to you." But kind of like David told Solomon, "You know what some of these men have done. You deal with them as you see fit." No, he didn't. He pleaded for them. What an example for you and I. These Jews were drinking the poison, but they expected that Jesus would be the one to die, and that's how some have described bitterness. Someone told a story of a house one time that had a sour odor, and they tried to get rid of it. They shampooed the carpets, and they used cans of Lysol spray, and they used Pine Sol and even Clorox bleach, but the smell would just keep coming back. And finally, they realized that scrubbing the surface was not taking care of the problem, and they're going to have to get to the root of it. And they decided it was coming from a certain wall, and they had a carpenter come in, and he tore that wall out, and they replaced it with a new wall, and then that took care of the odor. And, you know, the root of bitterness has the same effect. In it can get inside of a wall of our hearts, and it can rot it, and the air gets permeated with this unpleasant odor of our sour disposition and our unrest. Now, there are a number of examples in the Bible of bitterness. There's Cain, who slew his brother Abel. And then there's Sarah, who asked Abraham to take Hagar, and then she resented Hagar when her plan worked. And then Leah and Rachel resented each other because of, you know, favoritism and fertility issues and so on. And Job's wife advised him, curse God and die. And Naomi told her people when she got back, she says, don't call me Naomi, but she said, call me Mara. And that means bitter. And then, of course, as we already have mentioned this evening, we have the Jews that demanded Jesus' death, these hard-hearted Jews. Well, I'd like to zero in on one of these stories, and that's the story of Naomi in Ruth 1. And if you care to turn to that, I'm not necessarily going to read it. In verses 9 through 14 there, that's when she was parting with her daughters-in-law on the road there. She advised them to go back, and she said it was hopeless for them to expect any more children from her. She said, there's no hope for you. You know, even if I could suddenly get married and have children right away, she said, would you wait around for him? No. She said, it's hopeless. You might as well go back and try to make a life for yourself and let me to my life, whatever that's going to be. And then in verses 19 through 21, maybe I'll read those. And they too went until they came, and now Ruth has decided to go with her. And they too went until they came to Bethlehem, and it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them, and they said, is this Naomi? And she said unto them, call me not Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. So imagine coming back into town, and they said, who's that? She's been gone a while. That's Naomi. And she said, are you Naomi? And she says, don't call me Naomi, call me bitter. Now, how would you feel if I would, you know, come into your presence and you would say my name and I would say, just call me bitter? I mean, usually people that are bitter won't call themselves bitter. It's always the other person's fault, isn't it? And, you know, when we hear that we're going to study from the book of Ruth, we often get warm and fuzzy feelings, but usually it's about Ruth, not so much about Naomi. Now, the book ends well for Naomi, but here she admitted that she's bitter. I'm bitter. And I think she's also saying that you can call her bitter because bitter things have happened to her. But she no longer had what she loved. And she probably didn't quite have the full picture that God had in mind for her. She did not realize that her daughter-in-law was someday going to be the great-grandfather of David, or grandfather, maybe grandfather of David. It wasn't very far away anyway. And so she didn't see God's plan. You know, and through the lineage of David, the Redeemer would come. And she couldn't see that far down the road. And so she didn't really enjoy her part of that, of God's plan there. And, you know, maybe you and I are going to struggle with the same type of bitterness. Maybe we've lost children like Naomi did. She lost two sons, and she also lost her husband. I mean, we'd have to say that's pretty tough role to hold. And we can hardly blame her, I guess we could say. But, you know, maybe due to illness or accident, you know, we have lost loved ones. And we tend to blame God. And why did this have to happen to me? You know, these things happen. We read about them every once in a while. And then we say, you know, think at least, they always happen to other people. And the person who it's happened to, yeah, this always happens to other people. Why did it have to happen to me? You know, an abandoned spouse may become bitter. And, you know, they may think, well, God, don't you see how much I'm struggling to raise these children? And he's out there living the high life. You know, why aren't you punishing him? He seems to be enjoying it. And maybe the honest businessman will see the dishonest businessman, you know, he's a crook, and he seems to be prospering. And they're saying, God, how can this man be a cheat and be prospering, and I'm trying to be honest, and I'm having a tough time making it? How do you let him get away with it? And maybe a childless couple becomes bitter because they say, you know, family, they have big families. Other people can have big families, and we can't even have one. And we tend to get the idea that if anybody hurts us, if we've been treated unfairly, then God should punish them. And if God doesn't punish them, we think he doesn't see our plight and even care about us. And we decide, well, maybe God isn't going to intervene in our circumstances. But yet we think he should, and so we can develop a root of bitterness because of that. And so we judge. We stand as a judge and jury and executioner in the lives of other people because we say God should be doing that to them, but he's not. And so it becomes a circular pattern. The more we dwell on these things, the more bitter we become. The more we dwell on the injustice we've suffered or the loss we've incurred, the deeper goes that root of bitterness. And there are a lot of spiritual problems that arise from a root of bitterness, but there are also a lot of physical problems even that arise from that. For a definition of bitterness, it's a profound grief accompanied by suppressed hostility toward unbearable circumstances. Okay, we have some very difficult circumstances, unbearable circumstances, we would say, and it causes us grief. And then because of that grief in us, it's a suppressed hostility. And so I think that's key there, that it isn't just blow-ups necessarily, it's suppressed hostility. It tends to churn within us, and it occupies our thoughts. And I guess that's one way that we can think about these things is, do they constantly, this person or whatever, we'll get to that a little bit more here later, but is that constantly churning around in our minds? It doesn't always need to be aimed at other people. It can be a result of intense disappointment, so maybe it's just we become cynical with life in general, and maybe sometimes even with God. And so when we can't resolve this anger, then it infects everyone around us like a plague. And we may think, we said it's suppressed, but that doesn't mean it's hidden. And I think we can usually tell eventually if people have bitterness. And so I guess what I'm saying here is it's very contagious. And so it's something that needs to be weeded out. And if we don't weed it out, we are going to be tormented by it. And the thing of it is, so often, sometimes the people against which we have bitterness are not even aware of it. They haven't intended to offend us. They didn't realize they offended us. Maybe they let a word slip that we took offense, or a sentence, or something like that. But they didn't intend to do that. And so they're unaware that's even happened. When we're treated unfairly, you know, we must respond graciously. And in 1 Peter 2:19 and 20, it says, "For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if when ye be buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently? But if when ye do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently, this is acceptable with God." Okay, and there's good logic to that, right? It's not heroic if you are suffering for your own misdoings, you know that. But when you are suffering for doing well, such as Jesus did, and then you take it patiently, that's more noteworthy. That's acceptable with God. Now, being treated unfairly is a fact of life. I think we all would agree that being untreated is a fact of life. It will happen. I remember a man who seemed to take anything against him, any wrong against himself, quite seriously. And I said, well, you know, being treated unfairly is a fact of life. And he says, yeah. He says, you know, he built on it a little bit. And he says, yeah, there's a certain preacher one time, and I don't know what they were discussing or whatnot. And he says, and you know what the preacher said? He said, and he almost got emotional. And he said, yeah, that's a fact of life. Just like, it's terrible to be treated unfairly. Well, maybe it is, but can we accept that we will be untreated fairly? Can we accept that maybe unknowingly, it's just we may have been the culprit and we have treated someone unfairly and maybe have planted a root of bitterness? And again, we'll talk about that a little bit later here. So how are we going to respond to being treated unfairly? You know, are we going to have anger and bitterness? Or are we going to have love and forgiveness like Christ did? Well, here are maybe some questions we can ask ourselves to see if we may have a root of bitterness in ourselves. Do we find ourselves being down on people and giving more criticisms than compliments? And someone in teaching on the home, just studied this at Bible school, but they made the point that for every criticism that you give, you should give 10 affirmations. And my wife and I joked a little bit about that, and that wasn't just with children, with others as well, because I was doing too much backseat driving one time when I had her drive, and after a while she got tired of it, and she's a good driver. But anyway, and then one time I joked, we came to, we have a lot of roundabouts, and we came to a roundabout. I thought she should have gone, and she politely waited. And so we were, another time she was driving, I said, well, I got to quick come up with 10 compliments before we get to that roundabout. But, you know, are we keeping track of that? We don't have to count them. But do we tend to be short with our compliments and long with our criticisms? And are we short with people? Do we snap people off and maybe are curt with them? And are there people that we avoid? And I think this is pretty important one. Are there people we avoid? Had a discussing with somebody one time, and we talked about brotherly money matters between brethren, and loaning money and some things like that, and not getting repaid and things like that. And in giving some cautions, I said, well, you know, maybe you can avoid one brother after church, but you can't avoid very many of them. You know, you need to be careful. And so that's a little bit something we need to keep in mind here. You know, are we avoiding, and why am I avoiding somebody? Is there a root there? Do we like to get people upset? Do we ask them loaded questions? And they like to do that with Jesus, didn't they? And is it difficult to talk to others without constantly bringing it up again? So you have this thing that keeps consuming you, this bitterness. And it seems like whenever you get together with someone and you get a discussion going, it always has to go back to that in your mind. You just need to keep rehashing and rehashing it. And sometimes people around you and family, whoever it may be, can get so tired of that. Maybe even wives can get tired of hearing again and again how their husband has complained about others misusing them. Do you find that your conversations end up in arguments? Do you feel that you are disappointed, that you have been mistreated, that you have been betrayed? Do we feel like God has let us down? If I would ask you, in fact, I'm going to ask you, do you have an enemy? Do you have an enemy? Does any name pop into your mind? Someone that is just a little hard for you to feel good about. And someone that if you hear something negative has happened to them, you tend to rejoice rather than suffer with them. You know, or feel compassion for them or feel sorry for them, however you want to say it there. Well, let's consider now the various incidents in our lives and our perception of them. And I don't know, probably some of you would remember keyholes. Do you remember what, you know, some of you know what a keyhole is, right? Where you could peek through it. It's kind of a round thing and then a line coming down. And you had these old keys, round keys, and then they had a thing down. And you would stick it, and you could stick it in from both sides. And back before we had more modern doors where they have a peephole in them, if you wanted to see who was out there, you would get down and you would peek out through the keyhole. I remember doing that as a boy. And sometimes we'd look out through that keyhole and you couldn't see much, but you could kind of see if there was somebody standing in front of it. Well, someone has likened our perception of a situation, what we can see through it. We have a keyhole perception of it. And all we can see is just a little bit. And that can even be contorted. When actually there's a big panorama out there that we almost need to see if we're going to understand the situation. But we can't see that. We only get a keyhole look at it. And so we look through the keyhole and then we decide what the situation, what's happening out there, and so on. What I'm saying is we have to be careful that we don't take our perspective too seriously. You know, and how does God accomplish his purpose for us? You know, it might be that one of God's plans for me is to give me adversity or mistreatment. You know, we might be going through an ordeal of being unfairly attacked. We may be lied about. We may have our reputation publicly smeared. We may have a loved one abandon us. We may have our dreams dashed because of circumstances beyond anyone's control. It may seem impossible that God has a plan for us in this. And Joseph is an example of this. And we see by hindsight what God's plan was through this all, but Joseph couldn't see it by hindsight like we do, and yet he had an understanding that God had a plan for him. And he told his brothers that. He says, you know, you meant it for evil. He said, God meant it for good. In fact, I think Joseph was really disappointed at the time that his father died, and then his brothers came back to him just saying, you know, don't take revenge on us now that, that our father is gone. And I think Joseph felt bad that they didn't trust him or that they thought he still had bitterness toward him. Because doesn't say he wept, I think. Yeah, he that sorrowed him that his brothers didn't trust him that much, thought he had bitterness against him. He could look back and he could forgive what his brothers had done to him because he could see plans, God's plan in it all. And he would look at this plan of God just dwarfing the sins of his brothers. Well, how does God involve himself with evildoers? You know, how does a holy God work through evil people and their evil deeds? James 1, 13 through 15 says, "Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed." So God is not the author of evil. And he doesn't tempt us to do evil. And he does not cause sinners to sin. And he may use their evil deeds to fulfill his ultimate plan. There again, in Joseph's life, it seems that God intervened to spare his life, but God did not cause the brothers to envy, and he did not cause Potiphar's wife to lust, which all had a part in Joseph ending up where he did to save the nation from starvation. You know, and so we ask the question, how about Judas Iscariot? Did he have to go bad just to fulfill prophecy? You know, it was prophesied. No, God simply let them reveal what was in their hearts. And there, as I said, God, whether it's 1,000 years in the past or the present or 1,000 years in the future, God can see one just as clearly as the other. And so he decided to use the evil King Pharaoh. He decided to use the evil Judas Iscariot after he fell. And he decided that he's going to use them for his plan. But he didn't make him go bad. That's why he told Pilate, and Jesus told Pilate, that he would have no authority over him if it hadn't been given to him by God. God works the events of life in each of our lives. And if we just only look at the short term, you know, we can end up in despair and anger and bitterness. And it's easy sometimes to see people who have hurt us and think about them. It could be loved ones. It could be our parents. It could be our children. It could be our grandchildren. It could be our grandparents, maybe friends who we thought we could trust, or maybe church members who let us down, or people at work who stabbed us in the back. And, you know, if we focus on each of them, and I've heard it said of people that they take any wrongs done to them, they just never forget, and they take themselves very seriously. But, you know, if we're going to just focus on them, we're going to dwell in the swamp of bitterness. And our enemies actually mean. Our enemies mean to harm us. Now, I said that quite often those who are bitter against don't even realize they haven't intended to. But if they are actually our enemy, and we have enemies, and I trust not in our daily lives so much, but spiritual enemies, you know, and it's their intention to harm us and to drag us down and to discourage us and to taunt us, or, you know, whatever they may do. But you realize that God has higher and nobler purposes. And God will take vengeance on them, and they will be cast into the lake of fire, just like the pagan nations that he used to judge Israel. He used these ungodly people to judge Israel, but then they will eventually get their judgment as well. And it's not only our enemies that can do this, but there are believers that may even give us hard times. And so sometimes it seems like a brother or sister is maybe unfair with us, maybe giving us a hard time. But you know, God knows how to discipline his children, and justice will be meted out. And let's not be too concerned that that person will be punishment. You know, there are times that matters like this need to come before the church, but let's not be anxious to see that these people are punished. We must be like Joseph, and we need to ascribe these events as God working behind the scenes. When I was a boy, we used to have a game at home that was called Masterpiece, and it was an art game, and it was there were just various well-known artists, and there was like four paintings by each one, and you tried to trade cards, ask people if they had the cards you needed, and you tried to get all of them by one. And one of these artists was Rembrandt, and I believe the picture of he painted an auto portrait. And as I recall seeing it, it's a lot of dark on it. I think he has a big brown garment on, and he has dark hair and everything. But there's a few flashes of red and some bright colors in that. And so if an ant would decide to crawl across that painting, and he's just looking down, and he's going along, and it's dark, 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 dark. Maybe just a little flash here, red, then it's dark, 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 dark. And they say, what a dreary picture. But remember I said the name of the game was Masterpiece. These were masterpieces. But if you could stand back and see that on the wall, it's a masterpiece. It had bright where it needed bright. And I certainly don't have. And so God can take these dismal pictures and they can become masterpieces if we can see them from a distance. And so often we can't or aren't willing to. And so we may spend a long time, you know, days or weeks or months or years in the dark tones of life, but God can make a masterpiece of our life. And maybe we won't even see the results in this world, but we'll see it in heaven. Well, I'd like to look at some keys to overcoming bitterness. And so I invite your attention now to Ephesians 4, and we're going to do a study here of pick out some verses in this, how we can deal with bitterness. Ephesians chapter 4. Let's read them. I'd like to begin reading with verse 25 and read through verse 32. Ephesians 4:25. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be ye angry and sin not, and let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers, and grieve not the Holy Spirit of God, whereby ye are sealed unto the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. So the first one in verse 25 I have is stop lying. And you say, oh, wait a minute, I don't tell lies. What we're talking about here is we are saying to ourselves and others that all is well. That all is well. When it isn't. You know, we deny those deep feelings that rob us of peace instead of coming clear. And so the first step in dealing with bitterness is to admit that we have it. Otherwise, we aren't going to be able to deal with it. And we don't necessarily go to that person and tell them that, how we feel about them. And maybe they may not be aware that they have offended us. But let's remember that forgiveness is not based upon an apology. Did the Jews that put Jesus on the cross, did they apologize to him there before he forgave them? No. We forgive on the basis of love and of mercy, and not because someone deserves it. You know, Peter was proud of his forgiveness, but Jesus tells him, you know, it has no limits, 70 times 7. And then he gives the parable of the unforgiving servant, where this one man was forgiven. This king forgave this one man a huge debt, one he could have never paid back. And then he turns around and goes and finds someone that owes him a small amount that he could have paid back, but he needed it immediately, and he grabbed him by the throat. And that's so the horrified people, and word got back to the king, and so he brought him back, and he says, you're going to be cast in prison till you pay it all. And here, people can see the hypocrisy of someone who has been forgiven so much, and yet they have so little patience with others that they can't forgive them for small things. And we realize that we had a debt that was too large to pay, but Jesus paid it all. He paid it all on Calvary's cross, which we are celebrating today. Forgiveness is a commandment. It's not an option. And it's based on God's forgiveness of us. You know, it's not a warm, fuzzy feeling. It's a choice. Acts 7:60, and this is talking about Stephen. He kneeled down and cried with a loud voice, saying, Lord, lay not this sin to their charge. And when he had said this, he fell asleep. So what does it take? You know, when we have somebody trying to hurt us, if we get slapped in the face, you know, it tends to bring up ire. At least it does with me. You get snapped by a twig in the woods or something, and it just has a way of upsetting us. And you can imagine when somebody was stoning someone else, I can imagine that they would aim for the head. And so these rocks were intentionally hitting him, and he asked for their forgiveness. And forgiveness prevents bitterness, and it prevents resentment. Someone has said forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has just crushed it. I read a story of some monks who were walking to another village, and quite a ways away, many years ago, and they came to a river, and there sitting on the banks of this river was an elderly lady who was very upset. There was no bridge, and she couldn't get across on her own. She didn't have the physical strength to do that. And so the one monk graciously offered that they could carry her across. And so the two men linked their hands. They got down and kind of in the dirt and the mud there, and she got on it. And they took her across. When they got on the other side, she thanked him and went her way. And the monks walked a couple miles, and the second monk told the first one that had offered, he says, why did you offer to haul that lady across there? He says, it got all dirty, and now my back is aching. And the other monk didn't say anything, and they just kept walking along about another few miles. After a while, and the second monk complaining along the way, and finally, after a few more miles, the second monk just collapsed on the ground and complained of his bad back. His back was hurting, and he just couldn't go on anymore. And why did they have to haul that lady across the river? And the first monk just looks down at him, and he kind of smiles. And he says, do you know why your back is hurting me and mine isn't? Hurting you and mine isn't? He says, I set that lady down 5 miles ago, and you're still carrying her. And I think that's a good picture of us, isn't it, sometimes? So let's lay it down. You know, we've been forgiven by God, but now let's forgive others. The second one I have is stop hating in verses 26 and 27. And hating is a strong emotion. Should only be exercised on sin. And, you know, it sets us in our ways, and it causes us to become aggressive and attempt to harm others. It destroys communication. It's kind of like the terrible disease of AIDS. It breaks down our immune system. And so that bitterness just breaks out. And eventually it'll kill us spiritually. You know, Haman is someone who had it all. He had it all, but he just allowed Mordecai's seeming lack of respect for him to just consume him. He even managed to get his friends and family into his bitterness. We find that King Saul was jealous of David, and he just let that consume him. And he just spent a lot of time and resources, you know, a king of a country, and he's out here chasing someone he's jealous of like a dog. What, didn't he have better things to do? It just consumed him. So, there again, being forgiving someone is a choice, not a feeling. The third one I have is to stop stealing. And by stealing, in verse 28 there, I mean we are takers. And some people are takers. They only look out for themselves. And that destroys communication. While givers will build bridges of communication to other people. Because, you know, they can see worth in other people. And so they'll build these bridges with kindness. And sometimes we think when there's kind of a disagreement that the weak person gives in, the strong person wins. But actually it's the opposite. It takes strength to give in. And that's going to yield the fruit of a productive, peaceful, fruitful life. Jesus says in Mark 11:26, if ye do not forgive, neither will your Father which is in heaven forgive your trespasses. And so the initiative to forgive should be on the offended party. And again, it's not, it is unconditional. The next one I have, number four, is that we need to stop cutting down. In verses 29 and 30 there, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. And grieve not the Holy Spirit of God, whereby ye are sealed unto the day of redemption. And some people excel at cynicism. And it can be funny sometimes. It can be witty. And I worked for a boss, and I worked with another person who were masters of cynicism. And they were funny. But someone was always the butt of their jokes. Sometimes it was me, too. And then it wasn't quite as funny. But, you know, are we using our tongue to build up? Are we using our tongues to tear down? Our mouth can be a fountain of blessing, or it can be a fountain of bitterness and cursing. You know, in one sentence, I can make someone's day. In one sentence, I can ruin someone's day. In one sentence, you can make my day. In one sentence, you can ruin my day. Our tongue has tremendous power. There again, it what comes from within. Proverbs 26:22, the words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down into the innermost parts of the belly. And it's just something, it's a wound that can't heal because we just keep picking the scabs. We just keep talking about it. The next one I have, number five, stop overreacting. You know, don't blow up. And, you know, that's a worldly reaction, is just to lose control and blow up. And I realize that Christians are born with tempers just like anyone else, but it needs to be controlled. I read a story, these weren't necessarily Anabaptists, but it was a mother who was a school teacher, and she had all boys. And she's a sixth grade school teacher, and she said people would ask her, well, don't you wish for a girl? And she says, no. No, you girls, I read this. I'm just quoting someone here to make a point here. But anyway, she asks, don't you want a girl? And she says, no, I don't. I'm a sixth grade school teacher. And she said, girls, boys will blow up and get it over with, and girls tend to be slow burners. And it takes a long time to cool them down, is kind of how she said it. And if someone is I think she was talking about tendency, but you and I both can relate to some people are slow burners, some people are just, there's kind of an explosion, and then they kind of get over it and move on with life. That's their natural tendency. Not that we're welcome to do either one that we want. James, if you're a violent exploder, James 1:19-20 says, wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. So anger should not be our first response. You know, let's listen first before we speak, and maybe it would be best we don't even speak at all if we're angry. And this is where so much bitterness can be generated, is by speech. So much. It isn't very often that we're going to take a physical punch to the jaw or something like that, but it's people's words, I think, that can be the source of bitterness. Now, for the slow burners, Hebrews 12:15, look diligently lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and there my many be defiled. And so this root of bitterness, you know, these deep-seated grudges and these hatreds that were just allowed to fester. And I think we can see that the slow burner type would probably be more given to bitterness rather than those who get over it and go on with life. And this bitterness can grab a hold of us and it won't let go. We have to weed it out. And it defiles many, it says. It doesn't just defile me, but it defiles those around me. Remember, we said it's contagious. And so often we tend to just deal with the symptoms rather than digging down and getting the root out. Because we don't like to deal with the roots. That's harder and it's uncomfortable and disturbing. But let's eradicate the weed, not just work on the symptoms. Number 6, let's pray for them. You know, one of the best ways to get rid of an enemy is to pray for him. It is hard to keep a root of bitterness against someone who you are actively and sincerely praying for. You know, pray that the Lord will bless them, not that the Lord will punish them. Pray that the Lord will bless them. Pray that their crops would do well. Pray that their children would rise up and call them blessed. Pray that, the good things that we can see, that's easier said than done. But we can pray until that resentment is gone. Matthew 5:44, but I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute them. And then my final one is love them. You know, we have not forgiven until we truly love. Now, love is kind of a general word in our language, and the Greeks like to think more about thinking, and so they have different Greek words for love, and three of them are eros, phileo, and agape. And so eros is a romantic love, phileo is a more of a family and friends love, and agape is a decision love, a sacrificial life love. And I like to say it this way. So this young man takes his young bride out for a candlelit supper, and while they're waiting on it to come, he looks at her across the table and he says, I just love that dark dress with your dark hair and your dark eyes, and you can put whatever colors work there. But he says, I just love that. And then he says, and I love the time I can, that's the eros love. And then he says, and I just love the time we can spend together. This is so fun to be off with just you. And you know, you're my best friend, and I'm always can enjoy life more when you're by my side. You know, that's the phileo love. And then he tells her, and I want you to know that if something happens on the way home tonight and you become a vegetable for the rest of your life, I'll be there for you. That's an agape love. And so something could happen to that young bride that she could become physically repulsive to him. And he says, I'll be there for you. And so we can love people that are repulsive if we decide we will. It's a decision love. It isn't a warm and fuzzy phileo love. And so we need to love them. You know, I need to ask myself, would I give anything in my power to meet a need that they have? You know, can God say to us, you're in the gall of bitterness? You know, does God need to remove a couple of rotten walls from our life? And, you know, we may be like that second monk, and we hold the pain of the past over others' heads like a club. And we maybe remind them of the burden we're carrying because something they did to us a long time ago. There was a couple named Bonnie and Gary Witherall, and they were in Lebanon helping the refugees in a nearby refugee camp. And I think they had a clinic there, and she would help young mothers there. And one morning, she was brutally murdered at the door of her clinic there. And her husband, Gary, was quoted the next day as saying, "God led us to Lebanon, and we knew that we might die. It's a costly forgiveness. It cost me my wife." And on that long flight home, while accompanying his wife's body, he came to a simple conclusion. God told him, "There's a seed that's been planted in your heart. You can either hate and become angry, or you can forgive." And so when these situations come to us and that seed's been planted, we have the choice to become resentful and bitter, or we have the choice of forgiving. It's our decision. And he said, "I decided to forgive." He did not want to carry that with him the rest of his life. And as I was thinking and working on this message quite a while ago, you know, a face from the past kept popping into my mind, and it was the face of a brother who I dreaded even going to church with. I would drive past a sale barn on my way to work, and I would see vehicles pulling in there with cattle trailers, and I'd say, "Oh no, a sale day today, that Wednesday, that means there's church tonight. I wonder what he's going to say to me tonight." That's how I felt. And then he eventually moved away. But that, if I'd ask a question like I did, "Does a name pop into your mind if I ask you have an enemy?" His name would pop into my mind, and I did not want that. And so I finally stopped, and I told my wife what I was thinking. I said, "You know what we need to do? We need to invite them back to our church. They hadn't been back for years, and maybe no one invited them, I don't know. But we need to invite them to church, and we need to invite them to our place for Sunday lunch." And so we looked for the opportunity, and it took a while, but eventually I got the opportunity. We were at a viewing, and we were at the meal there, and they were there. And so I asked him, "Hey, will you come visit church and come over for lunch and stuff?" And he just kind of shrugged it off and wouldn't give an answer. But you know, I felt that put it to rest. I felt I had peace. I held out the olive branch, and maybe he was uncomfortable for whatever reason. But we saw him not long ago, and I just don't have those feelings anymore. And so I'm happy for that. In fact, he's had some disappointments in his life with his family and stuff, and I actually feel compassion for him. I feel sorry for him. And so, you know, can we have peace? You know, can we get rid? You know, I had a rotten wall. I had to get rid of it. And I was tired of the smell. And I wanted to replace it with the precious ointment that ran over Aaron the priest, or as the dew of Hermon, you know, that comes from brethren dwelling together in unity. So how about you? Can we determine by God's will to get rid of root of bitterness and reach out and build bridges of love and compassion? That's all I have this evening. I believe we'll stand for closing prayer.